Hello, it's Thursday the 5th of May and welcome to our Children's Day edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. On this 100th anniversary of Children's Day, President Moon Jae-in has stressed the importance of respecting children's rights and personalities in a personal message. We'll have more details in news briefing shortly. Later for Korean Politics Digest, we discuss the 110 key policy tasks unveiled by President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol and his team this week, as well as the latest on next month's local elections. And then coming up for Explore Korea, we'll be finding about a special exhibition marking the 100th birthday of the late sculptor Kwon Jin-kyu at the Seoul Museum of Art. Let's begin Korea 24. Families across the country were out enjoying the beautiful weather today as the nation celebrated its 100th Children's Day. National leaders took the opportunity to speak out about the future of the nation's children and what we can do for them in the present. For more on this and our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio News anchor Tom McCarthy. Tom, hello. It's good to see you.
Hi, Jungle. Thanks for having me.
So politicians lined up to commemorate Children's Day in some way today. And in keeping with tradition, the president welcomed children from around the nation to the top office as well. Can you tell us what the festivities entailed?
Yeah, President Moon Jae-in met with 90 children from schools nationwide to spend time with him at the presidential office compound. It was the first in-person Children's Day celebration since the start of the pandemic. Along with the education and health ministers, the president welcomed the children to the office, and the group had lunch before playing games with the president and first lady, and the president gave copies of books by acclaimed Korean author Lee Soo-ji, which she had signed.
In addition to the afternoon activities, the president also made a statement. So what did he say?
President Moon posted a statement on his social media emphasizing children's value as members of society, saying that love alone is not enough and called on adults to respect their rights and personalities. He added that children learn the wisdom of life from adults, while adults learn about the innocence of life from children. He also asked all adults to care for children as if they were their own, so that all of the nation's children can dream about a bright future and grow in an environment that facilitates healthy development. He also made references to some of his administration's achievements relating to children. He first mentioned the Children's Allowance Initiative, which started in 2019. This program pays families 100,000 won a month for each child under 6 years old, regardless of economic status. This stipend was intended to provide some relief for the financial burdens on parents. He then referred to the passage of the law last year that prohibits corporal punishment against children, which made Korea only the 62nd nation globally and 4th regionally to ban physical discipline.
Meanwhile, President Moon was not the only national figure to make comments on the holiday with a message. Both the ruling and opposition parties made statements. What did they have to say?
The ruling Democratic Party released a statement through their spokesperson Shin Hyun-yong, who took a more somber tone. She said that the nation still hasn't done enough to protect children from abuse and cited a harrowing statistic. 43 children died last year due to abuse. She continued to say that South Korea ranks dead last on the OECD's Children's Well-Being Index. A past report by the OECD noted that a relatively high percentage of Korean children lack consistent communication with their parents. She then called for an increase in a national awareness of children's rights and said the nation needs more substantive measures to prevent child abuse. She said the DP will do what it can legislatively to eradicate violence against children and create a society where children can grow happily without discrimination or exclusion.
So the DP mapping a course for the future, it seems. What did the opposition have to say?
The People Power Party spoke through their spokesperson, Kim Hyung-dong, who also focused on rather bleak stats. He noted that the number of child abuse cases in 2020 reached almost 31,000, and that marks a 65% jump from 2016. Kim attributed some of the abuse to what he referred to as blind spots in the law, which he blamed for some high-profile cases of abuse in recent times. He then discussed the incoming Yoon Suk-yeol's administration's plans to tackle the issue, which includes the establishment of a system that prevents child abuse and measures that support healthy childhood development, but he didn't elaborate.
Well, it's good to hear that amid the political polarization dominating headlines in recent weeks, both parties can agree on the importance of securing a brighter and safer future for the nation's children. Now, while politicians in Seoul were busy making statements related to the holiday, there was a notable and uncharacteristic lack of press releases from the leadership in Pyongyang. After the seemingly successful test launch of a ballistic missile on Wednesday, the state-run media was unusually silent on Thursday. So what can you tell us about this?
Yeah, as of Thursday morning, none of the major state-run media outlets, most notably the Rodong Shinmun and the Korean Central News Agency, ran any sort of coverage on the successful launch from the day before. This was an extremely atypical response from the North's news outlets.
How so exactly?
Well, historically, the North releases news bulletins about things like leader Kim Jong-un's activities or ballistic missile launches the day after they happen. However, there has yet to be any sort of update from the North. Pyongyang has previously not run coverage of a launch if it failed, such as the test launch in March that exploded right after takeoff.
Yes, while the North stayed mum on the launch, other countries were quick to respond, including the U.S. I understand the Defense Department issued a statement.
Correct. John Kirby, the press secretary for the DoD, said that the Pentagon is still analyzing the latest test and that it is deeply concerned with the North's continued provocations. He added that the U.S. is consulting closely with both South Korea and Japan as it assesses the launch and the aftermath.
It should be noted that May is a busy month for Seoul with the inauguration of President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol and the visit to South Korea by U.S. President Joe Biden. Did Washington think those events may have influenced the North's latest launch?
When asked about the timing, Kirby said that they did not think the North's decision to perform the launch was related to any external goings-on. He added, though, that there is never a good time for these kinds of tests from Pyongyang. He also said that the threat from the North grows with each launch as it is able to learn and use that knowledge to adapt their program, which is a growing threat not only to neighboring countries but to the entire Indo-Pacific region.
Now, I mentioned the inauguration of President-elect Yoon, and there's been a related development today. What can you tell us?
Yeah, the U.S. announced that it is sending a presidential delegation to the inauguration ceremony. The group will be led by the husband of Vice President Kamala Harris, Second Gentleman Douglas Emhoff, who, like Yoon, is a lawyer. There were concerns that the U.S. might not send any delegation due to President Biden's visit just 10 days later. There were also discussions about which U.S. official would lead the delegation, but several names mentioned are going to be traveling with Biden, so in the end, they went with Second Gentleman Emhoff.
Yeah, so after settling on the Second Gentleman, who else is joining the delegation?
Emhoff will be joined by the interim head of the U.S. Embassy in Seoul, Christopher Del Corso, and Labor Secretary Martin Walsh. There are also four members with Korean ethnicity, including Lee Min-jin, the author of the critically acclaimed novel Pachinko.
Now, that wasn't the only South Korea-U.S. related news today. I understand the Bank of Korea made a statement about the U.S. Federal Reserve's recent interest rate hike. What did the BOK say about this and what it means for Korea?
Well, the BOK basically said that the move by the U.S. to raise its benchmark short-term interest rate by half a percentage point was in line with market expectations, marking the first time in 22 years that the Fed raised the rate by 0.5%. This led BOK Senior Deputy Governor Lee Sung-hun to warn of more volatility in the domestic market. He also attributed uncertainty to the Russian-Ukraine war and the slowdown of Chinese economy as a result of their COVID-19-related lockdowns. He asked all the relevant parties to strengthen their monitoring of developments so the government can prepare for any possible impact those risk factors may have on Korea's financial and foreign exchange markets.
Let's move on to some other headlines. The National Intelligence Service announced an important development today. What can you tell us?
The NIS is now an official member of the NATO Cooperative Cyber Defense Center of Excellence, becoming the first Asian country to join and one of five non-NATO members, with the other 27 being NATO member states.
And how does this membership benefit South Korea?
Well, the organization came about after the cyber attacks by Russia on key entities in Estonia in 2007. After the attacks, NATO formed the group to facilitate the sharing of cybersecurity developments among their member states, and now Korea has unfettered access to that trove of knowledge. So the NIS said it will use this membership to strengthen the nation's cybersecurity response capabilities with the aim of developing the best system in the world.
And finally, let's get a quick update on the COVID-19 situation before we go. What were the latest numbers?
The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency said on Thursday that Wednesday saw 42,296 cases, with 23 coming from abroad. This brought the total case load to 17,437,068. This marks the 15th day that the total clocked in below 100,000. There were 79 deaths reported, which brought the total death toll to 23,158. With the fatality rate remaining at 0.13%.
That's where we'll leave it for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
In under a week, President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol will take office. And in preparation for that, Yoon and his transition team announced a list of 110 key policy tasks this week that the next administration will undertake. We'll take a closer look at this list for our segment now, Korean Politics Digest, as well as look at the latest polls concerning the June 1st local election and speculation over whether some major political figures will join the races as well. We do that with our pair of expert guests. First, we have joining us on the line Law Professor Cho Hee-kyung from Hongik University. Professor, hello.
Hello.
And next to me in the studio, we have Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-joo from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies with us as well. Professor Kim, hello to you too.
Hello to you too as well.
On Tuesday, the Presidential Transition Committee announced a vast list of 110 key policy tasks to pursue under the government of incoming President Yoon Suk-yeol. Committee Chair An Cheol-soo said the new government's national vision was built upon the concept of, quote-unquote, re-emerging Korea, a nation of people living well together. The tasks include commitments on recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, the normalization of the real estate market, scrapping the nuclear phase-out policy, and improved financial sustainability. However, what stood out most to some was perhaps what was not included. Most notably, there was no mention of abolishing the Gender Equality Ministry, a key pledge made during Yoon's campaign. The transition team responded today saying that the promise to abolish the ministry still stands. But Professor Cho, looking at this list, what stood out to you from this announcement?
What stood out for me was that although those one-line pledges made during the campaign were mostly kept out of those 110 key policy tasks, they still had budgetary independence for the prosecution office, which was a bit of a surprise because that really sort of runs counter to the general trend and policy of having better supervision and oversight and checks and balances over the Office of Prosecution. And I was a little bit surprised that they have still retained that. I think it sort of depends on whether you take a glass half full or glass half empty approach to the key policy tasks that they've come up, because on the one hand, you can feel relieved that saner heads have prevailed and they have chosen to modify some of those one-liner policies, which really were just, you know, campaign gimmicks, I think is all I can say. But at the same time, it's easy to become cynical about this, and it's actually easy for people to become cynical about this because you are making these promises without any intention to actually keep them. It was just a convenient, opportunistic kind of promises that attracted big attention, managed to get a lot of support from the population that they targeted, mainly young men in their 20s and 30s. But now that they've accomplished their goal and it's not so convenient and they rather have the need to attract the other part of the population, they just ditch them. I mean, that's really no way to run a campaign or make that kind of presidential campaign pledges.
Okay, Professor Kim, what about you? What did you focus on? Was it more what was missing from these key party tasks, as Professor Cho calls them, some of the campaign gimmicks that have been dropped? Or did you view some of the other pledges in a more favorable light?
See, I have a personal bias on this because I used to work on drawing a policy statement like this. It was a long time ago under Kim Dae-jung government. When you have to produce this whole set of policy, you know, the emphasis and stuff like that,
right.
Balance is very important. And so I have sympathy for these people working on this kind of producing this kind of stuff. And because of this, my bias, I have to say, job well done. Very good balance overall, covering key points, the role of the government, and then how the economy will be, you know, managed, and then industry promotion, human resource development. I mean, this is covering the whole entire function of the government, and quite well balanced. I have to say that because of my previous experience, it's a very difficult job. Having said that, things that I notice is first of all, this is a government that's coming that has come in that is coming in with 0.73% vote margin. And that is, this is a government that does not enjoy absolute majority of people's support. So therefore, they really had to pay attention to, I guess the same word that I used a few seconds ago, balance. They were trying to appeal to the broader spectrum of people and emphasizing that the government, that this new government is coming in with an open and committed manner to service people. So I thought those messages are pretty fine. And up front, I went through the whole list of 110 policy objectives because a lot of people are really interested in this. So, you know, I need to know what's going on. But overall, 110 policy tasks. The first group here, it's a group like the first 15, they are about the reforming and changing from the past or addressing most urgent ones. So things to know, going beyond this obvious expected ones like post-corona management and things like that, those are all expected ones. But of course, number three is the return to nuclear power. That a lot of people had been anticipating. And some of these reforms that Professor Cho had talked about is included there. Number six is media reform. You know, I'm speaking here in the KBS studio here, but there have been criticism. This is my personal observation, okay, my memory. There have been criticism that the public, the broadcasters like KBS, NBC, they have been under the influence of the government at the time. When there is a progressive government, there is a progressive influence. Conservative president comes in, and then there will be a management that's conservative and swinging around the media's position altogether. And and as a number six goal, you know, the Yoon government is saying they're going to change that. And I'll be extremely interested in that because the role of media is so important. And even though this conventional media is a fast declining industry because of the high-tech media, but, you know, changing, reforming this conventional media would be very, very interesting and critical, important task going forward. So some of those ambitious goals are something that I'm noticing. And the obvious ones, again, are the like government emphasis on relying more on market principles, deregulation. Those are all expected ones. So that media point is something that I was really being drawn into in terms of my interest.
Professor Chu, anything else that you noticed from the list? Do you think we'll see a very different administration from the current Moon administration, looking at those policies?
Well, if you were to put a positive spin on things, then certainly, as Professor Kim said, they seem to have focused on balance. But if you flip it around, you could basically say that apart from a few of the key tasks, any party could have made this policy task list, meaning that you know, there is no real huge difference. There is no imprint of, you know, what's a Moon administration going to be. You know, what's their key philosophy in terms of governing. And in a way, I'm actually thinking that that's a positive thing because, as we know, he's a complete political neophyte. And from what he has shown so far, I don't think we can put much store in terms of his ability of judgments and making, you know, key political decisions.
Sure.
So it's just as well that there is not a huge discrepancy and huge changes that are being introduced.
Professor Kim, perhaps not adventurous enough?
Well, as someone who had worked on this before, it's extremely difficult to introduce a completely new set of ideas unless your government is coming in to change everything, like Lee Myung-bak government. After 10 years of progressive rule, they came in with really bold vision and everything. What was the result? Hubris. They really went overboard and created a lot of political uncertainties. So this time, this was naturally expected result, and I admire it.
Okay, well, Yoon has laid out his administration's roadmap. We will see how it is put into practice. Let's talk now about the June 1st local elections, less than a month away now. And let's first look at the races we know are taking place in the Seoul mayoral race. current Seoul Mayor Oh Se-hoon of the main opposition People Power Party. He's leading former Democratic Party chairperson Song Yong-gil by over 20 percentage points in a new KBS poll released on Monday. It was conducted by Hanguk Research from Friday to Sunday on 1,600 adults in six regions, including Seoul. It has a confidence level of 95% with a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. In the race for Gyeonggi governor, PPP candidate Kim Eun-hae received support of 38.7%, while the DP's Kim Dong-yeon garnered 35.6%. We should point out that in other polls, the DP's Kim is actually showing to be leading by a significant margin, so we should take that into account. But Professor Kim, no real surprises in this whole race, this whole mayoral race, but perhaps a closer race than expected maybe in Gyeonggi.
Yeah, absolutely. Seoul's case, Oh Se-hoon has been there for about a year for so far, and nothing really negative for his interest altogether, only positive ones such as the victory of the presidential race for his party. And so the positive momentum is being maintained, so it will be extremely difficult for Song Yong-gil to overturn. And I still personally, my own personal view is I still don't fully understand what Song Yong-gil's plan or strategy is to turn the table around. Kim Dong-yeon and Kim Eun-hae's competition in Gyeonggi province is something that really excites me. They're completely different figures, two different figures, policymaker and media personality. And so public exposure versus policy contents, who will be winning this? It will be really, really interesting. It will tell us a lot about the nature preference of the people of Gyeonggi province, whose characteristics we kind of know. It's a greater Seoul area, quite urban, well-educated, and less political fixation until, I guess, I don't know, Lee Jae-myung's time, when they really showed clear inclination for DP. But this time, I think their independence will come out once again, and so it will be a really, really tight race and very interesting race between completely different characters on each side. So it really excites me to watch this.
Professor Chul, what are some of the perhaps variables or issues that we need to watch out for in the lead-up to the elections?
Well, this is such an interesting set of local elections because it's being held so soon after the presidential election. And so typically it would have been an extrapolation or an extension of the presidential election. And so you would have thought that the winning party in the presidential election would have had upper hand. But as a result of the People's Power Party basically shooting themselves in the foot because of all those missteps taken by the president-elect so soon after the result of the election with the Yongsan move and, you know, all these sort of breaking of the pledges and all sorts of and these scandals and also the appointment of the cabinet going just not very well at the moment. It seemed that for some time the balance was going to shift to the Democratic Party, but the DP has now managed to, you know, snatch defeat from jaws of victory, it seems, thanks to their botched job of passing those prosecutorial reform bills, which, you know, they succeeded, but they really lost a lot of support as a result of that. And they, you know, locked themselves into this kind of framing error. You know, they accepted this, you know, handle of Gomsuwambak, which was actually not the case. You know, they should have really kind of made up a better moniker, you know, for what they were trying to do, which was to try to provide better checks and balances for prosecution powers and all of that. And so, you know, it's still a month away, and a month in politics is a long time. There might be other things that happen which affect the outcome, but it's certainly much, much closer race than everybody had expected, and particularly the Gyeonggi provincial governor's race I'm watching with a great deal of interest.
Sure. Finally, let's touch upon some races where we don't know yet still who might be running. Parliamentary by-elections are set to be held in seven constituencies concurrently with the June 1st local elections. The DP has yet to nominate candidates for Seongnam, Incheon and Changwon, but there are growing calls for former presidential nominee Lee Jae-myung to run from within the party. Lee, who previously served as the governor of Gyeonggi province, is speculated to register as a candidate for Gyeong district of Incheon. Professor Kim, What do you think about this speculation? I understand there are also negative views on Yi's candidacy within the party as well.
Yeah, there is a strong view about the timing of it, because the presidential election was over only a very short time ago, and there's such a big name running again for the National Assembly district itself may look kind of uneasy in the eyes of many people, and they're indeed raising their voice on this case. For me, rather, the issue here is Lee Jae-myung running in Incheon Gaeyang district, which used to be held by Song Yang-gil, who's now running for his mayoral seat in Seoul. What I mean by that is too much an easy game. You know, Incheon Gaeyang, DP territory, Song Yang-gil did a good job, right? And why? Why Lee Jae-myung such a big name running in such a like a comfortable race? He should show more ambitious. So he should go for something more visible, something that can actually, you know, like excite people more. This is like, I need a job, and I want a job in National Assembly, and I'm gonna find the easiest way to get this job, and that doesn't make me feel very comfortable about it. I'm being reminded about No Myeon's case when he was running again and again and again in Busan in order to do something about this regional division. You know, as a Gyeongsang province person taking side with the Progressive Party, he wanted to get elected in Busan, and he tried many times, and he failed every time. I think that kind of gut, that kind of courage, that's what excites people. And Lee Jae-myung, if he does it this time, for those people who cared about his presidency, may actually lose their heart because it's going to be such a comfortable game.
Professor Cho, do you think Lee Jae-myung will run?
Well, that potential candidacy for Gaeyang district being touted for Lee Jae-myung is further tainted because there is speculation that the reason why Song Yang-gil is running for Seoul mayoral race is so that he can give up this safe seat for Lee Jae-myung to run. And, you know, I mean, obviously it's some rumors and we don't know whether it's true or not. Who knows? But people are talking about it, and if Lee Jae-myung does accept and, you know, run for Gaeyang, I just don't think it's going to, you know, give him many points. You know, what's the upside, as Professor Kim said, if he's actually, you know, putting his hat in the ring for a difficult district, somewhere where he's actually showing to be sacrificing himself for the party, then you might, you know, think more of him. But to take such an easy pick, I think is actually going to reduce his reputation. But having said that, to run in a very difficult district is also not an easy choice for him either, because he's just run for as the presidential candidate for the major party, the ruling party, and then to come out and lose to somebody else, a small fish in the National Assembly race, that's also not boding well for him. So if I were Lee, I would rather sit this one out, really.
And on the other side, speculation is mounting that Yoon Sung-yeol's transition team chairman and former presidential candidate of the Minor People's Party, An Cheol-su, is set to run for the Pundang district of Seongnam as a candidate for the main opposition People Power Party, and is expected to make an official announcement soon. Professor Cho, do you think An will run in this race?
Again, what's the upside for An to run in a, you know, National Assembly race? He's served in the National Assembly before. You know, what would he want to achieve as a result of that? I would have rather thought that he might actually challenge for the party leadership position rather than running for this particular race. But, you know, certainly there is a lot of talk about An Cheol-su running for the Pundanggap district. So who knows?
Professor Kim?
Yeah, this is a flip side of the coin that we talked about for Lee Jae-myung here. An Cheol-su running for Pundang district that used to be taken by, was represented by Kim Eun-hae, who's now running for Gyeonggi province, you know, governorship here. Easy district for PPP or conservative candidates to run. So what another case of seeking a job and trying to find the easiest way to get a job There's no political message here. There's no political significance, symbolism, nothing there. So I don't know. If he needs a job, fine.
Maybe a bit of a musical chairs going on.
Exactly.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up there for our Korean Politics Digest segment today. Professor Kim, Professor Cho, thank you both for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, it today is Children's Day, which is a national holiday. That means the stock markets are closed, so no stock market update. And instead, we go straight into our next segment, Korea Trending, where we take a look at some of the other news stories and headlines that have been trending online in Korea today. And for that, we have our contributor, Jenny Sa, joining us now. Jenny, hello and happy Children's Day.
Happy Children's Day.
Yes, thank you for coming in on this holiday as well. We are heading straight into our stories today. So, Jenny, what do you have for us first?
First, South Korea's web portal giant Naver will introduce a new work system called Connected Work in July, which will allow its employees to choose when and where they work. According to the company on Wednesday, they will add on to existing practices that allow employees to choose their own work hours to include how much time they need to spend in the office.
Yes, remote working, of course, became the norm for many companies during the COVID-19 pandemic, and there were important discussions about what companies would do next after the pandemic was over, whether they would go back to working in offices every day or whether there would be a shift towards embracing working from home more. And it looks like Naver has adopted to lean towards the latter. So how will their new Connect Work system work exactly?
So the new system will be classified into two types, Type O and Type R. Employees will decide each half of the year which type will best suit their needs for work. Type O, or office-based work, is for employees who choose to go into the office at least 3 days a week, while Type R is remote-based work, and it will be for those who telecommute. And for those who choose Type R, shared desks will still be prepared so that they can freely come into the office when necessary.
Right, so sometimes employees will have to come into the office. Are there any guidelines about that specifically?
Yes, even under the connected work system, there will be times when face-to-face meetings are unavoidable. For example, when taking part in collaborative work, teamwork strengthening activities, or for onboarding of new hires. And Naver will provide a separate guideline for these situations.
I see. Now, I understand that this isn't the first time that Naver has made changes to give its employees more freedom.
Mm-hmm. Last year, the company's affiliate Line gave its employees the choice of how much remote work they could mix into their schedule starting in July. The CEO of Naver, Choi Soo-yeon, stated that the company will find ways for its employees to immerse themselves in their work in an optimal environment, focusing on the intrinsic value of work rather than the when and where.
Right, so Naver has taken another bold decision, it seems. It'll be interesting to see whether productivity or efficiency is affected at all, and if not, whether it will encourage other companies to adopt flexible work systems as well. Let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us next?
Prosecutors in the Gapyeong Valley murder case have filed for the annulment of the victim's adoption of the suspect Iuna's daughter. The filing was made on behalf of the victim's bereaved family, as it's difficult for the family to do so due to legal challenges. At the family's request, the Incheon District Prosecutor's Office filed a suit with the Incheon Family Court on Tuesday to reverse the adoption, which would also take away Lee's daughter's rights to inheritance.
Yes, we have talked about this case on the show a few times before, and it has made headlines in Korea. But can you catch us up on some of the essential details of this case?
Yes. The suspects, Yoon Hae, and her accomplice, Cho Yeon-soo, are accused of killing Lee's husband, surnamed Yoon, in a drowning incident in 2019. They evaded the police for 4 months before their arrest on April 16th. And on Wednesday, the suspects were indicted on charges of murder, 2 counts of attempted murder and attempted insurance fraud.
Right. So Lee and her accomplice accused of killing Lee's husband. Lee had a daughter before she met her husband, the victim. Mm-hmm. And when they got married, the husband illegally adopted her daughter. But the victim's family is now looking to annul the adoption. What kind of relationship did the victim have with his adopted daughter?
So during the 2 years and 3 months of marriage, there was virtually no contact between the two of them. And they did meet in court when they filed the adoption papers. And Eve's daughter was born in 2011 before the suspect and the victim met. And Yoon applied for the adoption of Eve's daughter 11 months after the two married in March 2017. And Yoon was granted the adoption in June 2018 before his death a year later in June 2019. And legal experts believe that the adoption was aimed at securing the deceased's insurance money and inheritance because Yoon's death not only allows Yi's daughter to receive the death benefit from his life insurance, but also makes her eligible to receive his bereaved family's estate.
I see, but the annulment would take away the adopted daughter's right to inheritance then.
Yes, that is right. If the court decides to reverse the adoption, it legally will cease to exist from its start. Therefore, the right to inheritance will also become void, according to the attorney Kang Hyo-won. His daughter will lose all her inheritance rights to Yoon's estate.
Right, so another twist in this extraordinary case. We will see which way the courts decide on this aspect of it. Let's move on to our last story now. I believe we have an update on BTS's comeback.
Yes, that is right. Last month, we learned of the release of a new album on June 10th. According to the group's agency Big Hit Music on Thursday, the upcoming album will be an anthology titled Proof. It'll consist of three brand new tracks in addition to the group's music catalog from their nine-year career. And the agency revealed details about the anthology on the fan platform Weverse and released a logo trailer featuring a sequence of past album artworks from their discography, teasing the June comeback.
Right, so it won't be a completely new album, but there will be three new songs. We mentioned previously on the show that the date coincides with their debut as well. I believe there is special meaning behind the release for that.
Yes, there is. The compilation album will celebrate the band's upcoming ninth anniversary, according to Big Hit Music, and will present their fans, who are known as ARMY, with a comprehensive collection of the group's music. The album will also serve as a chance for the members to reflect on the meaning of BTS as a group and its past activities, as well as mark the opening of a new chapter in their 10th year. And Proof will consist of three CDs, and will be filled with colorful songs that contain the members' thoughts about the past, present, and the future of BTS.
Okay, we'll wrap it up there for Career Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Jenny, and we will see you again next time.
See you next time.
Next up, it's our weekly segment, Explore Korea, discovering more about the nation's cultural, historical and travel highlights. And we have joining us in the studio this week our arts contributor, An Jae-woo. Jae-woo, hello. It's good to see you.
Likewise, Jae-woo.
Yes, happy Children's Day, Jae-woo.
Oh, yeah, happy Children's Day to you. And by the way, I believe it's your first Children's Day with your first child.
Yes, it is.
So it's kind of painful to say that because we're both at work, but I'm not a father. You are. Anyways, still.
It's fine. He's, yeah. I would say, still a baby rather than a child.
Well, yeah, that's true, yes.
I'm not expecting any... I don't think he's expecting anything special today. But I believe we did have a nice afternoon in the park.
That's great.
Okay.
Beautiful.
So let's get into our topic today. What are we talking about?
Well, it's actually has a little bit to do with what we just discussed, right? Because let's think about it. Today's Explore Korea is the first one in this year's May. Mm. And the month of May in Korea has a special nickname, 가정의달, which literally means family month, right? And there are two very, very important days in this month we celebrate the love and greatness of you know, family. And the first day is, of course, May. I'm going to talk about this one first to exercise just a little bit of filial piety. May 8th is 어버이날, Parents' Day. And today is, as you said earlier, it's May 5th, a.k.a. 어린이날, Children's Day. So, Jae-woo, I thought it'd be nice to talk about a Korean artist whose work over many decades has been moving A, children, and B, the child inside the adult. And that's exactly how I felt when I recently went to an exhibition celebrating the centenary of his birth. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce to our listeners the luminous life of the late great sculptor Kwon Jin-kyu.
Yes, an influential figure in the history of Korean modern art indeed. For those who might not know, though, can you give us a brief introduction to the artist?
Yes, let's first do a rundown on his bio. He was born on April 7th, 1922 in Hamgyong, Namdo province. And there's a rather important reason why I've just mentioned his date and place of birth. We'll get back to that in a minute. But then fast forward to 1943, he went to Japan as an art student. And let's not forget that 1943 is 2 years prior to Korea's liberation from Japanese colonial rule, with the end of World War II, of course. But anyways, in that year, 1943, he went to Japan as an art student, but soon afterwards found himself involuntarily working at a Japanese factory. He was one of those 450,000 men who were pretty much just dragged into this forced labor as the Pacific War is getting more and more intense. And of course, as for the women, we all know what happened there, unfortunately, with the sex slavery. But yes, so in his case, he had to work at a factory. And then what happened was he escaped from the factory and then made an illegal entrance back to Korea in 1944 and took refuge at a hideout in his hometown until Korea's liberation from Japanese colonial rule in the following year. And then 1 year afterwards, 1946, he moves to Seoul in order to attend the Seongbuk Painting Institute, Seongbuk Hoehwa Yeonguso in Korean, founded and led by the legendary painter Lee Kwede. And Chang-ho, I will dedicate a full edition of Explore Korea to Lee Kwede sometime in the future, likely when a gallery exhibits his work. But then 2 years later, in 1948, he goes back to Japan to spend some time with his ill brother. And a year later, still in Japan, he enters the Musashino School of Art and becomes a student of the Japanese sculptor Takashi Shimizu. Yes, I just said Takashi Shimizu because Takashi Shimizu was actually a globally renowned Japanese sculptor. Mm. And of course, as you and I both know, for the Japanese, they have a tendency of putting their family name after their given name, like the Western word order of names. And of course, there's also that kind of a tendency here in Korea, but I believe it's more stronger in Japan. And the only reason why I'm saying this is because in case there are any listeners out there who are Korean and they're artful, so they know their art, and if you're asking yourselves, does Jeo mean Shimizu Takashi? My answer is absolutely yes. Okay.
Right. Yes, Jeo, thank you for explaining that. So it seems his early years as a young artist was at a very tumultuous time in Korea then, going back and forth from Korea and Japan.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, there are a few things I find worthy to mention regarding the artistic significance of his years at Musashino. Number one, his professor Takashi Shimizu was a student and serious admirer of the great French sculptor Antoine Bourdelle, and this is where the Bourdelle influences of Kwon Jin-kyu's earlier works come from. FYI, a little bit of academic ancestry. So, let's see. Kwon Jin-kyu's teacher was Takashi Shimizu, and his teacher was Antoine Bourdelle. Guess who Antoine Bourdelle's teacher was? Hint, the thinker.
Right.
It was, yes, the great one and only Rodin. Yes, right. Of course. Okay. That's how the academic ancestry, or as I would say, artistic ancestry, as a matter of fact, goes. And then number two, this period is when Kwon Jin-kyu starts winning considerable fame in the Japanese art scene as a young star sculptor, winning a number of different accolades. And number three, this is also when a fellow student at Musashino volunteered as his portrait model. Her name was Tomo Ogino. The two became a couple and eventually got married.
Right, I believe that last point had a lot of significance for his art as well, not just his personal life. Can you tell us a bit more about that briefly as well before we talk about his latest exhibition in Seoul?
Yes, so to provide our listeners with the possibly clearest understanding of where I'm getting at with this is I first want to mention a very iconic film and its lead actor. We're going to go with In the Name of the Father, lead actor obviously being the one and only Daniel Day-Lewis, right? Was In the Name of the Father a well-directed and well-written film? Of course it was. But can we ever, and I mean ever, imagine this film without Daniel Day-Lewis? right? And the reason why I'm mentioning this is because it's very similar between the relationship of model and sculptor, or model and sculpture.
Right, okay.
And another thing, there's another important reason why I mention amongst all those great films In the Name of the Father is because both the situation of that film, and it was based on a true story, right? And the situation which Kwon Jin-kyu and Tomo Okino were embedded in were post-colonialist struggles, right? So Kwon Jin-kyu and Tomo Okino began to live together in 1953 and got married in 1959. However, Kwon Jin-kyu had to come back to Korea in the same year he got married in order to take care of his mother after his father passed away. Artistically speaking, this was the time he took a few steps away from his craft cultivated in Japan and began to develop a more original craft in Korea.
Mm.
And last but not least, 1959 was 6 years before Seoul and Tokyo reestablished diplomatic ties. Therefore, a time when the entry of Japanese people into Korea was highly restricted, thus his wife could not go with him.
Mm.
In fact, Kwon Jin-kyu's parents-in-law sent him divorce papers 5 years later in 1964. The divorce was finalized in the following year, and this unfortunate event has some serious artistic significance as well. I'm going to save that for the finale of today's Explore Korea.
Okay, so with all that background knowledge that we have now then, can you introduce us to this latest exhibition in Seoul? First, what is it called?
Yes, it's called Kwon Jin-kyu Centennial, Angel of Atelier. The venue is Seoul Museum of Art, and it runs through May 22nd.
Yes, this is the exhibition that has received much attention lately.
Absolutely.
As well, particularly because there is a piece that has been lent by the K-pop superstar,
yes,
RM of BTS, a sculpture of a horse, I believe. Aside from that, though, what works are on display here?
Yes, let's take a look at two in particular, or one group of pieces and one individual piece, the former being his set of animal sculptures, including the one you just mentioned.
Mm.
And this is actually why I wanted to talk about this particular artist on this wonderful day of Children's Day. Now, Kwon Jin-kyu was highly fond of fauna, and if you take a look at his works, you don't necessarily have to be an art critic to realize and visually palpate the strength of affection he had for animals.
Mm.
A pair of key concepts which are worthy to ponder on while one appreciates his animals and pretty much his entire oeuvre are essence and archetype. First, essence. Kwon Jin-kyu was the kind of artist who really, really wanted to properly explore and discuss the very core of life and existence. And I believe a possible motivation behind that was of his situation of first coming from a North Korean area of Hamgyong.
Mm.
And this was when he was born, there was no such thing as two Koreas,
sure,
right? And then it gets divided after only a few years after Korea's liberation from Japanese rule. And then he gets married to a Japanese woman. And because of the non-existence of diplomatic ties, it's difficult for her to follow him back to Korea. And so these kind of situations, I think for him, kind of motivated him to ask himself, what is it that defines myself and therefore puts me in these kind of situations? What will be the very essence of my existence and the relationships that I make? And I think in that sense, when he sees, when you come from that kind of a background and you take a look at animals, how pure they are.
Okay.
And they don't have those kind of political or sociological identities, right? And just like I would say children, which relatively have that less compared to adults. So I think in that sense, his art has that much of a significance when it comes to the animals. Plus, they're just wonderful to watch.
Right. There's a timeless quality to them. Right. So those animal sculptures are one side of his works. Mm. What about the other side?
Yes.
this individual piece.
Sure. And this is where we revisit the tragic love story between the artist and his wife. This one is named Reunion. And it was made in 1967, 2 years after the divorce. However, 1 year afterwards, in 1968, he gets a chance to exhibit his works at Tokyo. And he does so, including this work.
Mm.
And at the very first day of the show, his now ex-wife comes to the show. And the two meet each other for one last time. And I want to say a few things about these two reunions. First off, and I believe a decent number of our listeners can relate to this, but when you physically leave your significant other, either temporarily or permanently, due to relocation, not only are you leaving the person, you're also leaving the place. Mm. And in the case of Kwon Jin-gyuk, and that's why I said two reunions, right? In the case of Kwon Jin-gyuk, coming back to Korea was parting from both his wife and an entire art scene where he constructed the cornerstone of his craft and which highly acclaimed that cornerstone alone. Now, that other breakup, the breakup between person and place, is something which I believe deserves attention as much as the person and person one, because A, saying goodbye to both person and place can be far more challenging than the already immensely challenging breakup of romance, and B, coming back to that place to exhibit a work on the theme of reunion apparently has a powerful context, especially when that work reflects how his craft, after all those years at a different place, has evolved in such a sublime fashion.
Right, so quite a moving context to this piece, mm-hmm. then. I believe we've just talked about a few of his works, but I believe there is much more on display on this show.
Absolutely.
A very significant show. 240 artworks, I believe, mm-hmm. encompassing.
It's a phenomenal
not just
show.
Sculptures, oil paintings, sketches as well. So we recommend our listeners to go check it out if they can. Once again, it's called Kwon Jin-gyu Centennial Angel of Atelier, and it's on view at the Seoul Museum of Art, or the Seoul Shinin Bisulgwan in Korean. That's where we'll wrap it up for Explore Korea today. Jae-woo, thank you, as always, for telling us about another great show, and we will see you again next time.
Super.
And that's it for our show today. Thanks for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so we hope you can join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.